And now the story of a woman. A woman whose story is repeated so often, it's ingrained on our collective imagination. She's an archetype. She is Eve. She's Juno. She is the good woman gone bad. She is Hester Prynne. As part of NPR's series In Character, my colleague, Andrea Seabrook, shows how this Puritan woman is still very much alive today.
Hester Prynne is the protagonist of Nathaniel Hawthorne's magnum opus, The Scarlet Letter. Any serious literary scholar will tell you that she is one of the first strong women in American literature and is still among the most important. She is veiled and complex and deep. So much so, says Professor Jamie Barlow of the University of Toledo, that her character is much bigger than the novel itself.
Hester Prynne lived before she was a character in Hawthorne's novel, and she has continued to be a part of our thinking as a culture because that notion of the bad woman, good woman dichotomy has existed for thousands of years.
In The Scarlet Letter, one of the first things you learn about Hester Prynne is that she is drop-dead gorgeous.
The young woman was tall, with a figure of perfect elegance on a large scale. She had dark and abundant hair, so glossy that it threw off the sunshine with a gleam, and never had Hester Prynne appeared more ladylike than as she issued from the prison.
In this opening scene, Hester Prynne is led out of a dark jail onto a platform where all the Puritan citizens of Boston can stare at her. She holds her infant daughter, born in prison, to her chest, and a bright red letter A burns on Hester's breast. She has committed adultery, a sin so terrible in Puritan Boston of the 1600s that she could have been hanged. Having to wear the scarlet letter is considered by some an easy sentence. Now, here's the second thing you find out about Hester Prynne. She is silent. She refuses to speak the name of the man with whom she committed adultery. Listen to this scene, enacted in a 1979 public television version of The Scarlet Letter.
Woman, transgress not beyond the limits of heaven's mercy. Speak out the name. That and thy repentance may avail to take the scarlet letter off thy breast.
Never. It's too deeply branded. You cannot take it off. Would that I might endure his agony as well as mine.
Speak, woman. Speak and give your child a father.
I will not speak.
This is our first glimpse at the inherent contradictions of Hester's character. God has made her beautiful, but she is a terrible sinner. She wears the shameful letter A on her breast, but she has ornately embroidered it too. She accepts her punishment, but she refuses to name the father of her child. Evan Carton is a professor of literature at the University of Texas at Austin. He says this duality, this complexity, has inspired writers ever since.
The multiple wacky interpretations of Hester begin in the book. They're what the book's about. One of the chapters of the book is called Another View of Hester. And throughout the book, what we get are multiple views of Hester authored by multiple different viewers of Hester.
The two main viewers of Hester are her husband and her lover. The man who Hester refuses to name publicly, the father of her child, is the talented young Puritan minister Arthur Dimmesdale. When Hester and Dimmesdale had their tryst, we learn, Hester's husband was thought lost at sea. Later he returns, calling himself Roger Chillingworth. What follows is a cruel and shadowy love triangle between Hester, the Reverend Dimmesdale, and Chillingworth.
The drama is really the drama of the patriarchal society's need to control female sexuality in the most basic way, you know, this classic sort of male anxiety. How do you know for sure whether your baby is yours? If you don't know that your woman and your child is actually yours, then you have no control over property, no control over social order, no control over anything. And that's the deep radical challenge that Hester presents to this society, and it's the working out of that challenge that takes place throughout the rest of the novel.
In some ways, Hester Prynne is less a character herself than she is an object that the men in the book define themselves by. Dimmesdale is in love with her, but she is his sin. Chillingworth is obsessed with her, but will not claim her publicly. And the elders in the Puritan community seem to care very little about Hester, except when her continuing existence seems to challenge their moral authority. Carton says Hester is a vessel that everyone in society projects their desires and fears and fantasies onto, calling into question the role of women in society. These are ideas people of Hawthorne's time were grappling with, says Professor Barlow.
Hawthorne, living in Salem, in Boston, and then later in Concord, was very, very aware of this growing feminist insurgence. Women's rights were a part of the cultural conversation.
The first women's rights convention at Seneca Falls, New York, was held while Hawthorne was writing The Scarlet Letter. For the first time in America, strong women like Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton were challenging the firmly established male patriarchy. Hester Prynne is Hawthorne's contemplation about women's role in society and what happens when they break cultural bounds and gain personal power. Hester is a sinner, yes. But she also survives. She builds a small business doing embroidery work. She raises her daughter Pearl by herself, fighting to keep her when the town governors try to take Pearl away. And over the years, she gains the respect of other women in Boston and becomes something of a quiet confidant for them. In a pivotal moment in the novel, Hester finally asserts her own will in her life. She meets her lover, Arthur Dimmesdale, in the forest and begs him to run away with her.
"Let us not look back," answered Hester Prynne. "The past is gone. With this symbol I undo it all and make it as if it had never been." So speaking, she undid the clasp that fastened the scarlet letter, and taking it from her bosom, threw it to a distance among the withered leaves. The stigma gone, Hester heaved a long, deep sigh, in which the burden of shame and anguish departed from her spirit. Oh, exquisite relief! She had not known the weight until she felt the freedom.
Oh, the scene in the forest and her trying to breathe some spirit into this man, and the moment when she lets down her hair, surely one of the great moments in American fiction.
This is Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist John Updike. He says the scene in the woods still makes him cry.
First he throws away the scarlet letter, and then, quote, "by another impulse, she took off the formal cap that confined her hair, and down it fell upon her shoulders, dark and rich, with at once a shadow and a light in its abundance and imparting the charm of softness to her features." How wonderful the power of the hair, the mystery of the long hair let down.
Updike finds the story so powerful, he wrote a trilogy of novels based on the characters of the Scarlet Letter. The last of those is titled simply S. In it, Updike's 20th century Hester is named Sarah.
I saw my modern equivalent as kind of a cocky, flip, sexy, free spirit. She was fun to write about because she was so irrepressible.
As somebody who has explored all of these angles of the Scarlet Letter and specifically explored Hester Prynne, why keep reinterpreting Hester Prynne?
Well, because she's such an arresting and slightly ambiguous figure. She's a funny mix of a truly liberated, defiantly sexual and independent woman, but in the end, a woman who accepts the penance that society imposed on her. And I don't know, I suppose she's an epitome of female predicaments.
The Scarlet Letter has been told and retold many times, with different parts of Hester's personality accentuated. A 1934 film casts her as almost a saint who takes her punishment willingly. The 1995 version, with Demi Moore as Hester Prynne, makes her overtly sexual and defiant. You can compare these Hesters at NPR.org. A clue into Hawthorne's feelings is how Hester fares at the end of the book. Her lover Dimmesdale dies a broken man. Hester raises Pearl, who goes on to live well. But Hester herself chooses to return to Boston, living out her years on the edge of the community that for so long treated her as a pariah. She chooses to wear the red letter A long after her punishment is fulfilled.
Never afterwards did it quit her bosom. But in the lapse of the toilsome, thoughtful, and self-devoted years that made up Hester's life, the Scarlet Letter ceased to be a stigma which attracted the world's scorn and bitterness, and became a type of something to be sorrowed over and looked upon with awe, yet with reverence too.
Hester's scarlet letter ends up being revered by the townfolk, perhaps as a symbol that throughout her life she bravely wore her sin out in the open on her chest.
We have Hester Prynne because we sin. We all sin.
This is Dr. Nancy Taylor. She's the pastor of the Old South Church in Boston and a direct descendant of the Puritans. Taylor says Hester's story is still very much relevant today.
The book explores the possibility of redemption. And one of the things it suggests is that to face our sins and to repent is a lifetime project. But it's also one that requires a certain self-honesty. I think in the book, Hester's the only one who really has self-knowledge, self-honesty, who acknowledges her sin. She is the one who develops as a human being.
All of the contradictions of Hester Prynne, guilt and honesty, sin and holiness, sex and chastity, make her one of the most important female protagonists in American literature. She is flawed, her character is complex, and above all, fertile. The idea of Hester Prynne, the good woman gone bad, recurs again and again. We as a culture are still trying to figure out who Hester really is and how we feel about her. And in John Updike's words, that's because she's a mythic version of every woman's attempt to integrate her sexuality with societal demands. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News.
You can hear extended versions of those readings from The Scarlet Letter and see how Hester has been portrayed in two very different film versions on our website. Just go to npr.org/incharacter, all one word, and while you're there, you can tell us about your own favorite fictional characters. Your essay could end up on the air.
Joining us from London is Edward Lucas, a reporter and former Moscow bureau chief for The Economist. He's written a new book about Russia and its relations with the United States. It's called The New Cold War. Welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning.
New Cold War is a provocative title. Do you mean that the old Cold War between the United States and the former Soviet Union was the first one, and now there's another one between the United States and Russia?
Well, it certainly is provocative, and I want to provoke and I want to wake people up, because I think we've been too complacent about what's going on in Russia. But I'm not saying that the old Cold War is coming back again. That was a global confrontation, it was military and it was ideological. And this one's different. Russia's too weak now to be a global threat of the kind that the Soviet Union posed. And it's not ideological in the same sense either. Communism was a very distinct, almost messianic ideology, and that's not the case now. Russia's a capitalist country in what I argue is a rather perverted form of capitalism, and at least nominally a democratic one, although as we've seen with the election, it's not going about it in a way that the rest of the world might count as true democratic contest.
So what is the new Cold War like?
The new Cold War is, first of all, it's much more in Europe than globally. It's a fight over Europe's backyard, who controls the political and economic future of the former captive nations, the countries of Eastern Europe that won their freedom back in 1989-91, and now are under threat by Russia, not from invasion, but from being bought. Not from tanks, but from banks. It's also a struggle for the soul of Russia, because we must not let the ex-secret police people in the Kremlin write Russia's history as a story of just authoritarianism and empire and say that's what Russia's all about. And thirdly, it's a struggle for our own values. Do we want to regain the moral authority that we had at the end of the last Cold War, which helped us win it, or do we really think that only money matters?
You talked about Russia no longer being a military power. If that's the case, then what other means do they use to enforce their ideas?
It's a mixture of cash, gas, and propaganda and bluff. Bluff works if we're afraid of a confrontation with Russia. When Russia threatens a confrontation, we try and split the difference and back down, and that's worked pretty well. Gas works well because every European country so far that has been presented with a bilateral gas deal from the Kremlin has taken it, and that's blown a wide hole in European energy security. It's about cash, because you can buy politicians, institutions, sometimes even whole countries, with the billions and billions of dollars that the ex-KGB people in the Kremlin have at their disposal. And it's about propaganda, because Russia's quite successfully managed to persuade some Europeans that America's a greater threat to world peace than Russia is. So it divides Europe, and also divides Europe from America, which were, of course, the great goals of the Kremlin in the Cold War, and one that they've come, in a way, closer now to achieving.
So what is to be done?
I think we have to engage Russia more. The United States hasn't done quite the right thing in some respects by not talking to the Russians on things like strategic nuclear weapons and on space, which are the two things where Russia really is a great power. It doesn't make America safer if Russia has such a small number of nuclear weapons compared to America that it goes to what nuclear strategists called launch on warning, that it actually increases the danger of an accidental nuclear war. So that's bad. And America, as the dominant space power, actually has a lot to lose from anarchy in space. So I think on those things we should engage with the Russians.
Mm. You also advise building oil and natural gas pipelines that circumvent Russia?
Absolutely, and this is the European end, because at the moment all the east-west gas pipelines cross Russia and are controlled by the Kremlin. So we can't go to Central Asia or the Caspian and say we'd like to buy some of your gas because it's cheaper or more reliable or whatever. The Gazprom tail is wagging the European dog, and that's got to change.
Now, I just have to say something that was that appeared in a review of your book in the Wall Street Journal. The reviewer suggests that by talking about this threat and bringing it to light, that you have performed a public service. But the last line of his review is, referring to you, he'd better watch out.
Yes, I read that with interest, and so did my family. But I think we have to be really tough on this. I was around in the last Cold War, and I was behind the Iron Curtain when we won it, and it left a deep impression on me. And I don't want to go back to those days.
Edward Lucas is a reporter and former Moscow bureau chief for The Economist. His new book is called The New Cold War. He joined us from London. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Lydon. Jimmy Breslin almost needs no introduction. He's been the consummate New York newsman for half a century, writing for The New York Post and Daily News, and most recently, Newsday. His latest book, The Good Rat, tells the story of Burton Kaplan, an informer who brought down the notorious mafia cops, two New York police detectives who had a lucrative sideline in contract killings for the mob. In the spirit of the book, we were eager to meet Jimmy Breslin at one of his old haunts, the Cafe Palermo, on Mulberry Street in Little Italy. John Gotti once had a clubhouse not far from here, but cafe owner, baby John DeLutro, says you don't see any wise guys in the neighborhood these days.
Nah, those days are over. But Little Italy's changed. It's all tourists. It's all tourists. If it wasn't for the tourists, we'd be out of business, put it that way.
We got a round of espressos and an order of the Palermo's famous cannolis while we waited for Jimmy Breslin, who finally appeared out of the bitingly cold New York winter afternoon with only a polar fleece pullover for warmth. Baby John DeLutro had a little problem with that title of the new book, The Good Rat.
How many years I know you? Since when is there a good rat?
There ain't
a good rat. Oh, be careful.
We settled in around a table. Breslin autographed a book for his old friend Baby John and ordered a double decaf espresso. He's been writing about the mafia for years. He even got beaten up once by a mobster who took issue with one of his articles. But as Jimmy Breslin told me, as crooked as those guys were, they never committed the greatest crime of all, being boring.
That's punishable with long terms in a penitentiary.
Now, the good rat of Breslin's title was a man called Burton Kaplan, and he was anything but boring. When he wasn't arranging mafia hits, he was running garment business scams, shipping hair grease to Africa, and selling Peruvian passports to Hong Kong. But Burton Kaplan wasn't the original subject of this book. Jimmy Breslin's publisher had sent him to the federal courthouse in Brooklyn to interview the two corrupt cops that Kaplan had ratted on.
And I hated them. Now I go into the court and I say, I'm going to have to spend 6 months doing this. I can't do it. I'll call at lunchtime. I'll go over and call the publisher and tell them, forget it. We'll see if we can find something else.
You hadn't heard of these guys before?
I heard everything I wanted to know about them. With this, the door opened and the prosecution started its case with a witness. He sits down. What's your name? Burton Kaplan. I said, what the hell is this? And the Jewish guy. And they ask him Are you in the mafia? He says, no, I can't be. I'm Jewish. I go, well, this guy's out of the... this is great. And he said, have you ever committed any crimes? And he, with a straight face, he had a shirt and tie, glasses. He blinked a little bit. Middle-aged businessman type. Like I did see him in the garment center. Have you committed any crimes? Murder, manslaughter, assault, kidnapping, selling Peruvian passports, cocaine, heroin, and everything but killing babies. I said, oh, my Lord, what is this? This is Dostoevsky. That's the one word that came into my mind.
And I think you compared him to Raskolnikov.
That's, well, I didn't. I go over, well, I would have, if I had a chance, I'd go over to the diner at lunchtime, and Benita Stein, who's a lovely
woman.
Who was
one of the defense attorneys, right?
Defense attorney, comes up to me and says, what do you think of the witness? And I'm about to mention Dostoevsky, and she says, Raskolnikov, and walked away. And that's what he was. And that's what he is. He's the best. The best.
But he thought he would never be a rat, right?
No, he was, for a time, all attorneys that anybody ever did business with him said he was the strongest proponent of omerta, the Italian. All the Italians were ratting each other out, were talking. You couldn't keep them quiet. Bert Kaplan held the line. He wouldn't talk. Wouldn't talk at all. And Mark Feldman, the district attorney, went in and said, what are we about? What is this about? What are you, the only honest man, the only real man who'll stand up? And Kaplan says, I can do my time, you know.
But then it eventually turned. It took him, I believe, 4 days to testify, right?
Oh, yeah, he could have gone a month. Don't worry about him.
And they got, he gave up eight different murders that these two cops had committed.
Up, sure. He could have gone longer. They couldn't get him on anything he says is right. I mean, he separates salt from pepper when he's talking. Just perfect. Don't worry about him. And they would make a mistake. The lawyer's trying to get at him. Defense, wrong counselor. Wrong again, counselor. He'd correct them.
Why'd you call him the good rat?
Well, it's just everybody. He said himself, I'm a rat. That's what I am. I'm a rat. He was a good rat for society. It's just a phrase. It's a good phrase. What are you questioning my taste? There's nothing like him. Nothing. You got to go back to St. Petersburg, Russia to find the guy in this league.
It's been a great pleasure talking to you. It really has. Thank you so much.
We here at the BPP know that you, our listeners, are smart people. And smart people who I'm guessing might like to read a good book now and again. So we decided we're just going to start a book club.
Why not?
We just decided it.
We're doing it.
It doesn't matter that Oprah's practically trademarked the phrase book club. We don't care. We want to do it too.
Here's how it's going to work, people. We're going to pick a book and we'll give you whole month to read it. You know, that's enough. You can do that. You can do it a little bit every day. We'll have a book club leader who will periodically visit us on our blog to remind us to keep reading and to give us stuff to think about and field your questions. Later on this month, we'll have our virtual book club meeting online, and our leader will moderate a discussion about the book and will generate some questions for the author.
And then we're going to interview the author of the book and ask him or her your questions.
I like it. Sounds good.
So here to unveil the first selection of the newly formed BPP Book Club is close personal friend of the BPP, Sarah Goodyear. Sarah is the partner of our web editor, Laura Conaway, and she writes about books for Time Out New York Magazine. Sarah is also a novelist in her own right. Her book, View from a Burning Bridge, was published last year. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you, Sarah.
Welcome, I saw you at the Christmas
morning.
Party.
Good morning.
All right, Sarah. Now, we didn't pick your book.
No. No,
but that would have been okay.
That might have been a little self-serving. So, no.
All right. So which book did you pick?
I picked a book called In the Country of Men by a Libyan author named Hisham Mater. He was shortlisted for the Booker Prize in 2006 mm-hmm. for this book. And when I read it, when it came out for the first time in hardback last year in the U.S., I just was really entranced by it. It's the story of a 9-year-old boy coming of age in Libya in 1979, and sort of the most repressive, brutal part of the Gaddafi regime when Libya was the most isolated from the rest of the world. And it's a wonderful book because it takes you into that secret world that we have so little idea of. We think of Libya as being this enemy. And sort of in the same way that maybe The Kite Runner or Persepolis takes us into this world that we know nothing about and makes it human and real. What's sort of tragic about this is that the author is in exile now. The situation in Libya continues to be very, very repressive. That's something we don't necessarily want to acknowledge now that Libya is more friendly with us now. And his father actually was abducted and has not been heard of since the 1990s. Anyway, but it's a beautiful book.
Yeah, what struck you about this? What stayed with you?
It's not only the story of a child growing up in this repressive society, but it's also the story of a family that's distorted and pressured by that society. So I am going to read a little bit from it.
I'm not sure we don't have time to read a little bit of it.
Will only increase the drama.
We'll put the passage you've chosen, we'll put it online.
Excellent.
And then people
can
read it. How about
Absolutely.
That? Absolutely. Sarah Goodyear is the BPP Book Club mistress. To recap your assignment, you have 1 month to read In the Country of Men by Hisham Motor. It just came out in paperback. You may be able to find it at your local library. We'll post info about it on the blog.
Thanks, Sarah. And that's it for Bryant Park this week. Thanks so much to everyone for listening. The BPP says goodbye to Pauline Bartoloni today. Pauline came to us from the leafy campus of UC Berkeley. Now she's heading on to new adventures. All the best to you, Pauline.
Absolutely.
You can join us online all the time at npr.org/Bryant Park. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Allison Stewart. And this is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
In the opening pages of a new novel from Canadian writer Frances Itani, an old woman sets out for a drive to the airport. Georgina Danforth Whitley has been invited to be one of 99 guests at Queen Elizabeth's birthday in London, 99 subjects of the Commonwealth who share the Queen's birthday. Itani's novel is titled Remembering the Bones. Alan Chews tells us what happens next.
Distracted as she speeds away from her house, 80-year-old Georgina Whitley loses control of her car and plunges into a ravine. She's thrown from the vehicle, and like a character in one of the Beckett stage plays her daughter produces, spends the rest of the story crawling a few inches a day back toward the wreck. As she grows dehydrated, chilled, and feeble, Georgina keeps herself alert by casting her mind back to scenes from her long life. She recalls prayers, recites poems, family homilies, and revisits the suffering of her grandmother after her grandfather's death. She also visits her own misery after the loss of a boy child in infancy, romance with her husband-to-be, and sickness and upheavals in small-town Canada, a setting that could be hometown for most any of us. Itani recounts these quiet dramas in a deceptively simple, often lyrical manner that might be compared to the music of gypsy guitarist Django Reinhardt, one of Georgina's favorite musicians. All mellow and scrambly is how the old woman describes Reinhardt's style as she fights for her life in the cold ravine. He made it sound easy, she thinks. He made it sound blessed. Most readers will find that Frances Itani's admirable novel has a similar effect.
The novel is Remembering the Bones by Frances Itani. Alan Chews teaches writing at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia.
And now it's time for Back Talk, where we lift the curtain on conversations happening on the Tell Me More blog and get a chance to hear from you. Lee Hill, our web producer, joins me in the studio as always. Hey, Lee, what are folks talking about out there?
Hey, Michelle. Well, they're talking about a lot of things. We discussed some provocative issues since our last Back Talk, so it doesn't quite surprise me. First, Kosovo. Their recent vote to declare independence from Serbia has a lot of folks talking out there. We seem to have gotten on the bad side of some of our listeners after we aired a conversation in which Kosovar Albanians in the U.S. reacted to the news. Well, as a follow-up the other day, we brought you perspectives from Serbs. Regardless of where folks stand on the historic vote, there's a lot of emotion about this. Listen to these words posted to our blog from Talent, who describes himself as an Albanian living in Tirana.
I believe independence is the only and the best solution for both Kosovars and Serbs.
I hope Kosovo heals from all its horrific past and moves on as a diverse, multi-ethnic society with European Union integration aspirations. Martin Luther King once said, "I have a dream." Kosovars can now say they had a dream, the dream of one day being a free people.
Thank you, Talant, and for all of you who wrote to us on this. We are still following the story, and there may be additional conversations we're going to want to have. In a special Mocha Moms conversation, we brought you the story of Hollywood screenwriter Trey Ellis, a single dad. Ellis talked to us about his new book, Bedtime Stories, and his status as an eligible bachelor who also has kids. Tanya, a listener who does not have children, wanted to share some thoughts about how she interpreted the conversation.
I date and have dated men with children. If your guests are not pursuing healthy, adult, intimate relationships, they are not providing a healthy example for their children. I want a loving man and children, and believe I can have both.
Okay, Tanya, we got the message. Well, finally, we talked to the CEO and co-founder of Caribou Books. Now, it was the nation's largest black-owned bookstore chain until recently, when Simbasana decided to pull the plug, citing not so much the competition, but issues pertaining to his love life and what he describes as a very personal spiritual journey. Now, Michelle, from the conversation, I had to admit at first I had a hard time connecting the dots on how his personal relationships translated into the closing of his business. But that's okay. We heard from Claire, who understood exactly what Simba was describing to us. She writes, "What a wise man. I think his advice about love and relationships in business is so true. I've spent time working and living in bookstores. One thing that struck me is the incredible joy that the bookstore brought to Mr. Sana's life, but at the same time, his ability to realize with acceptance and humility that it was over. I find this to be true among all bookstore owners I know and respect." And Michelle, I have to add, after speaking with Simba after the show, I did get a somewhat better understanding of where he was coming from in his story.
Well, thank you, Claire, and thank you, Lee.
Thank you, Michelle.
Remember to tell us more about what you think and to see what other listeners are talking about. Go to npr.org/tellmemore and blog it out.